Hey guys, and welcome to the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report, presented by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. The first podcast to bring you the local fishing report for Alabama's lakes and rivers, whether it's good, bad, or ugly. I'm your host, Nick Williams, and this week's show is brought to you by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. Are you frustrated by your typical hunting and fishing magazines? Are you tired of reading content meant for guys up north or in the Midwest? Don't get left behind following the guidance of guys who don't hunt and fish in your home state. Pick up a Great Days Outdoors magazine subscription and become a better Southern outdoorsman. Great Days Outdoors magazine can be found at your local Books A Million, Tractor Supply Company, Rural King, or you can save and buy online at greatdaysoutdoors.com. Alrighty guys, welcome back to another week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report. Spring is in the air. I just seen the dogwoods blooming on a little drive this afternoon, so we're rolling along. Be summer before you know it. Today we're here to talk with Eric Cagle. Eric is an Alabama guide who right now is doing some work every year he goes, and he fishes up around Grenada Lake. So we're going to catch up and see what the crop year looking like up around Grenada. Eric, how you doing today, sir?
Hey man, I'm doing good. We've been on the long days over here. We do some 8-hour trips, so it's longer days than I'm used to. I about done got tired over here.
Well, I know you probably had a good fishing report to give when you told me that you was going to have to roll it back a little bit because you were still cleaning fish. That's usually a good sign when I'm talking to my guides.
Yeah, I've been here since February the 23rd, and I booked a month over here, so I booked 30 trips over here in a row. So I'll be here through March 23rd. But it's been really good so far. We've caught, I think I've been here for a couple weeks, and we've caught 5 over 3 pounds and a couple 291s, a bunch of 280s. I mean, we've caught a ton of fish over the 2.5 pound mark. So they're out there. We've seen several today. Just everything's got to work out perfect to get those big ones to bite. And but it's a lot of fun chasing them over here. It's just totally different. I can kind of leave everything I know about fishing in Alabama when I come over here, because these fish are just totally different here.
Well, elaborate on that a little bit, because that's always interesting to me. You're right. Like I've noticed, I've fished at this point, I don't know, 40 or 50 something out of 67 Alabama counties, and I've noticed that different watersheds fish definitely have their own personalities. Elaborate on what makes them different from the crappie back home.
Well, I mean, in central Alabama where I'm at back home, and when I say different, it's just different fishing. These fish over here don't really relate to structure a whole lot this time of the year in the spring. They're just kind of open water roamers. And if you think that you're good with boat control back home and you can sit on a brush pile and catch a fish, and then you think you're going to come over here and catch them, you better get over here and practice a little bit. These fish don't sit still. You got to really, really know how to chase them and be good with boat control and all that good stuff to catch these fish. But it's worth the reward when you do catch one. I mean, there are some absolute giants over here roaming in this muddy water. But we long pole fish over here this time of year too. You got to kind of hold it on their nose, and they can't see real well. So if that jig gets more than a foot or so away from them, then they lost it. You got to get it back to them where they can see it. So just real muddy. I mean, probably an inch to 2 inches visibility is all they have over here in this muddy water in the spring. But it's definitely a lot different. Our blackfish at home school up in the winter and early spring, and these fish over here don't. You're fishing just individual fish here. So, that's some of the main differences is, they don't school up here, and these fish are on the move. They don't hardly ever sit still for you. You gotta chase them, chase them down and catch them. So it's just a big change coming from Alabama in the late winter and early spring to coming over here. It's just totally different.
You mentioned, comparing it to the blackfish that we had back home, and I know we were talking a little bit off air about the differences between white crappie and black crappie, and you were telling me that that's mostly what you're fishing over there is white crappie, whereas back home you got black crappie, and that's what I've got here in my local waters. Do you think the differences that you're seeing, is that a difference that boils down to, the differences in the lakes and the rivers themselves, or do you think that's mainly a species difference, like the difference between fishing for white versus black crappie, or do you think it's a little bit of both?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I've been all around the country the last 10 years, tournament fishing and traveling. I mean, I've been to a lot of different lakes in the last 10 years. And these fish in this, at Grenada Lake and on the, really, you know, Grenada, Enid, and Sardis, especially Grenada Lake, they're just a different breed, man. They grow faster. They act differently as far as, I mean, most of these fish over here, a lot of the fish that we're catching over here, you know, are 6 inches under the surface. I mean, they're just shallow as you've ever seen. And, you know, today we fished in 3.5 to 4 foot of water all day. Those and still in 3.5, 4 foot of water, those fish are 6 inches to a foot under the surface. So it's just, they're just different here, man. I could go on and on, but they're a different breed here in this muddy water in Mississippi than any other whitefish I've ever fished for anywhere else. It's just something different here about the water. And, you know, I think this place gets a new lake effect every year. You know, they drain it 25 foot or so every year, and then they bring it back up with the spring rains. But, you know, you've heard of the new lake effect. I think this place gets it every year, and that's why it's so fertile. You know, all that grass and vegetation grow on the bank here, and then when they bring that water back up, it's like a new lake effect. And I think that plays a big part of why these lakes over here are so fertile. But these fish are they're something else. If you've never been over here to Grenada, Mississippi, and caught you a big whitefish, you need to come try it out, because it's something to see, I can tell you.
Yeah, you were showing me some pictures of some really, really big fish. I know a 3 pound or close to 3 pound crappie. I mean, just looks humongous, especially down here compared to the fish we catch, where we really struggle to catch them legal with 8 inches. You know, I don't know if it's the saltwater intrusion that makes them small or what down here on the coast where I'm at, but you'll catch good numbers. But it's hard to catch big fish, so it's cool to see some big old fish like that. And everything you're saying, man, talking about finding them shallow, like, it sounds perfect for fly fishing. That's something I'd love to get up there and try. The only thing that I've found where I struggle fly fishing for crappie is, you know, you kind of struggle. It's kind of frowned upon, you know, tipping your hook with crappie niblets or using any type slab sauce or anything like that. So in muddy water conditions, you kind of struggle, because all you can go by is color. You know, they got to see it to hit it. And it's really hard to add. You know, it's not like you can add a bladed underspin or something like that to make it make a little disturbance and have them sense it that way. What would that muddy water, what's your best jig color for conditions like you're talking about, where you're saying you think they're only seeing a lure, you know, a couple inches to a foot in front of them?
Man, we use really bright colors over here. I know it sounds crazy that muddy orange water, an orange jig would work, but Grenada, you know, that's a common color here. I mean, a lot of people use orange here, and they can see it in that water somehow, some way. Lime green, that's been my best color the last week over here, just a solid lime green jig in that muddy water. They seem to be able to see it. So, you know, and you can use different colors, because, I mean, you can get it real close to them, but it seems like they see those brighter colors in this muddy water a lot quicker than, you know, using a dark color.
Yeah,
so that's kind of what we found over the last few years.
Well, I've got some chartreuse woolly buggers tied up. I may have to tie me some orange and some lime green, and hot pink is one that I find seems to work pretty well down here. So that's good to hear. How long, like, you talked about them being really shallow, fishing 3 to 4 feet of water and catching them, you know, they're in the top foot or so of the water. How long is that pattern going to last? Like you mentioned, I think you're going to be there till like the 23rd or something this month. Is that when, in your experience, you know, the bite kind of tapers off, or how long should that pattern hold?
I mean, they don't all spawn at the same time here. I mean, they'll, you know, like yesterday I caught a fish out in 8 foot of water and she had eggs pouring out of her, you know? So, I mean, there are a few of them that are starting to play around. You know, I expect it'll last through the end of March, maybe the 1st of April, and then it'll get slow for a few weeks until those fish recover, you know, from the spawn. But some of them are starting to play around now. I think you got another couple weeks, you know, of that shallow water fishing. But because, like I said, you know, all of them don't spawn at the same time, so you're still going to have some waves coming in to do their thing. So I think you got another couple weeks here to catch them like we're catching them now. And, you know, it's probably going to get a little better. You know, some of these fish will spawn on stumps and stuff up shallow. So, you know, a lot of this wood over here, you know, you can go up and find, you know, a male and a female on top of a stump, you know, spawning. So, you know, that's to come too. And you're seeing a little bit of it now, a lot of males on the stumps now, but those females are getting ready to go in there with them.
Do you do anything different, you know, catching fish that big? I mean, that's a much bigger fish than what we're used to down here. Does that change your tackle or anything? Like, I imagine that's a heck of a fight, a 3 pound crappie on the average panfish setup. I mean, that's a three pound bass is a pretty good fish. I imagine a crappie pound for pound fight's harder than a bass, at least off the start.
They fight pretty well. I mean, you know, I use a 14 and a 16 foot rod over here this time of the year, and you know, we use braid. I mean, we pop them. So these fish have, you know, they're bigger fish. They got thicker mouths, so you don't have to worry about ripping the mouths as much here as you do, you know, in other places. But you know, we're basically, you know, using those long rods like a cane pole, and you know, sticking them out and putting in their face, and when they pop it, you know, you can go ahead and as they call, rip their lip, you know, so you can pop them pretty good. And they do fight. These fish run sideways, you know, like a submarine down here, but they'll come on up to the top, and you get a net under some of those big fish. But when they start getting up by these stumps here, that's when it really gets fun, because, you know, I can get the little casting rod back out and put me a slip cork on if they're stationary and on those stumps, and kind of you can sit there and catch them on a cork on top of those stumps when they get up there. So it's a fun time.
Yeah, it sounds like a blast. You talked about cleaning fish earlier. The big question, in your opinion, which is the better eating species? You rather eat white crappie or black crappie?
I don't think you can tell the difference in them. Myself, I would size wise, I would much rather eat a 10 inch fish than a 14 inch fish, but I don't think you can tell the difference in a white crappie and a black crappie when they're fried up sitting on a platter. I don't think there's any way to tell the difference.
Well, there we go. Well, that's the important question out the way.
They both taste good.
they both taste like fish, huh? They taste like they need some lemon and some tartar sauce on them, huh?
That's right. That's right.
Well, you talked about coming back to Alabama. If folks are looking to get with you, book a trip once you get back over on this side of the state line, what's a good place to get in touch with you at?
They can check me out on Facebook, just Eric Kegel Fishing, or just plain old Eric Kegel. My phone number is always 334-558-4097. And I'm booking for November right now in Alabama. So those fish they'll be on brush, ready to eat in November. So I've got some November dates that I need to get booked. So give me a shout.
There we go, guys. Y'all definitely check Eric out. Eric catches more big crappie than about anybody that I know. Eric, as always, I appreciate you being on the show.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
This week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report has been brought to you by Hilton's Real-Time Navigator. The days of heading out and blindly looking for good fishing areas are pretty much over. Don't waste time and money on fuel searching for fish. You need the recent highest resolution images to not only know where to go, but where not to go. The knowledge provided by today's technology is critical when planning an offshore fishing trip. Make the choice that professional captains all over the Gulf make and choose Hilton's Real-Time Navigator. The easy-to-use interface and excellent customer service will have you on the fish every time you go. Check it out at hiltonsoffshore.com. Alrighty, guys, next up, reporting in from the Cahaba River, we have the man, the myth, the legend, we have Stephen Rockarts. Stephen, how you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm trying to put some spice in my intros, man. I'm working. I've started to watch some old, like, WWE, and next time we talk, I'm going to really have something for you.
Hey, I felt the spice. I didn't know what to expect. I like it, though. I like it.
Good deal. No. Well, yeah, tell me all about it, man. I was out there today. We was I met with Will Strickland. Like, we was out on the Tensaw River here, and I'm looking out my window. Like, it was beautiful this morning. It's beautiful today. Like, the bugs are popping. Like, down here, at least, fish are moving up shallow. I can finally catch them. You know, and I mean, you've talked in the past about weighted lines and dredging the deep pools, and I'm not any good at that, but now they're coming up and they're hitting top water where I know how to get at them. So what's it looking like on the Cahaba?
That's real close to it. I'm not fishing as much sink tip lines as I was. Definitely no more full sink, just throwing the regular floating lines and pushing it up, throwing it up in the current the right way, so the current will push your line down for you, and the fish are moving, man. They're coming out of the deep pools, like you said, they're doing down there. They're coming up into the shallower water. And, you know, the best thing about it is they're not passively feeding anymore. They're actively feeding. So they're not like they're just sitting there waiting for something to float by them. And you've got to be real strategic on your entire approach. It's just, if you can get it within 5 or 10 feet of them and they can see it, they're just going to come out and smoke it, which is, in my opinion, probably one of the most fun times of the year. So everything's pre-spawn. Everything's got a belly. And, man, they are on the hunt. So it is a great time. And we're supposed to have some good weather tomorrow. So I'm going to do my best to not work tomorrow and try to see if I can get out before this other storm front comes in.
Yeah, I know that's something down here as well. Like we're looking at the water levels, like over the weekend, we kind of dried up and we got cold, you know? So like right here in spring, like it's trying to get all the conditions to line up. Like down here, you want it to be warm for a few days. You don't want them nighttime temperatures to drop down into the 40s because that kind of messes everything up. You want your water to kind of stop, you know, rushing through the woods, turning chocolate milk color is what I'm looking for. So like we had last weekend, the water was low and it was just right. But then the temperatures got low. And so it wasn't quite perfect. And like now the water's coming back up with that rain, right? Like the temperatures are fine. Like the temperature's rising, everything's looking good, but our water level's coming back up. What's it looking like up y'all's way? How's the Cahaba looking like? Is it clearing up? Do y'all still have kind of that spring flood to it? Or
right. So actually, we were kind of the opposite of you then last weekend. Last weekend, we got smoked a couple of days before the weekend. It was Friday, and our water rose for about 24 to 48 hours. And as it rose, you know, everything kind of got blown out. But for some reason, the ground didn't soak it up as much as it has been. So that it was a very slow descent. So we're just now, as of yesterday, the water finally got back from a storm 5 days ago, finally got back to good fishable water levels, clarity, et cetera. So, so we're hopefully going to have a good, I mean, if I was on the water today, I guarantee you we'd be catching some fish tomorrow, the same thing before the storm front on Friday, because we're up here in central Alabama. But it's looking pretty good. You know, like you said, the spring levels, et cetera. Spring levels right now for the water are coming pretty clear. We've got just the right amount of water, just the right amount of turbidity. And the temperature doesn't matter as much here as much as it does the turbidity and the flow and then clarity. That has a little bit more to do with it than the temperature here. And we're to that point right now where we are, I would say, at the peak or the start of the spring fishing season. And we have been for about a week or two, with the exception of last week's storm, which is great because we're like, 4 weeks early on our season, which is fantastic. But hey, I've said it before, I'll say it again, fish don't have calendars. They just go off the weather. And if the weather's telling them to feed and to move, that's exactly what they're going to do.
That's something I've noticed down here on my end. And I've talked with several guys in different part of the state who commented that it seems like this year we started warming up a little bit quicker, like spring come on quicker. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. I asked several guests on last week's show. We talked kind of a little bit about water temperature and the spawn. I think I measured it this morning, and if my thermometer was accurate where I was fishing, like the surface temperature was at like 65 degrees. What are y'all looking like up there, and at what temperature would you say most of them bass are going to spawn?
Right. So something that I've personally noticed over the years, even if we have a little bit of a cold snap and those water temperatures get down in the 50s, low 50s, 60s, or low 50s, maybe the 40s, late in spring, it doesn't seem to affect the spawn that much. I think that the bass on these free-flowing creeks, now it's going to affect your lake fish and your big river fish a little bit differently, but on the creeks that I fish, there's so many other elements. I think that the fish wait primarily on the steadiness of the water level, the water flow, and I think they're really, really dialed in on that. So they're not going to go trying to spawn if there's obviously a lot of storm fronts rolling in. So sometimes we'll have a late spawn. Sometimes we'll have a little bit of an earlier spawn. Obviously, temperature does have something to play with it. So I'd say about 50 to 60 is usually when they're going to – they'll be ready to do it. But by no means do I ever see them spawning before a storm. I usually see them after there's been a good lull for a week and it's a good 14, 21-day stint of just – less weather than what's typical. And it's kind of strange how they know that that's how it's going to happen, but that's generally when I see them spawning and when they get on bed. And you always get out there the same time every year. You start fishing, you're like, man, today's gonna be the perfect day, look at all these conditions, everything's great, you know, we haven't had rain for a week, and then all of a sudden you won't catch a single fish. That's a lie. You'll catch some, but they're tiny. And then you get out there and you know it's just not a great day, and you're like, man, what is going on? But if you pay attention to it when you're doing all that, you can find the bigger fish on bed. And I think that I just think that they are much more in tune to the water levels and the flow than they are temperature for that reason. But that's all I got to say. That was a lot.
No, it is a lot, and that's something that I'm getting more into. So I've mentioned it with other guests. Like, my preoccupation for the first almost 30 years of my life was with deer, rutting bucks, right? And diving into all of the research out there, what makes deer go into rut? You know, is it the moon phase? Is it the temperature? Is it the length of the photo period? You know, like, all of these different theories. Like, why do these deer in different parts of the state of Alabama go into rut different? And, you know, is it genetic? Like, and there's some good research on that, and there's some good research on spawn, but that's what I'm learning as I start to pay more attention to it and try to narrow down a set of parameters, is that it really depends on your body of water. Like, it's hard to read in a textbook and come away with an answer like, well, the bass on Tensaw River are going to spawn on this date, or when the water reaches exactly this temperature, or whatever. Like, it's kind of it's a wild animal. Like, you can narrow it down, but it seems to be universally what guides tell me is that when you think it's starting to get close, start going fishing as much as you can. And
that's
if you
right.
get lucky, you'll hit it.
That's right. Hey, no, you're right. And that's what it is. It's a generalization of everything, an accumulation of everything that you've learned. And then it's just a matter of fact of just applying it.
That's
and every
it.
Year you're going to figure out that you didn't know what you were talking about.
That's it. The biggest variable is, much like, I don't know how they do it. I need to talk with a meteorologist and just pin him against a wall and ask him, how do you always make it rain on Saturday and Sunday? And then I need to find an ichthyologist and be like, why do our bass always spawn on a Wednesday afternoon when I got work?
I don't think they want to answer that question to your face. They'd be afraid you're going to give them a butt whooping.
I don't know what it is, but like, I guarantee you, like, I'm sitting here in the office today and I will see a report from a fishing buddy. Somebody will have pictures of a stringer full of crappie that I was not able to catch. And then if I go this weekend, there won't be anybody catching crappie. That's just the way the worm turns.
Hey, it is what it is. And the crappie are moving right now. We had a trip a couple weeks ago, and just a bycatch, we caught several crappie and loads of bass. We caught the average size of bass, you know, a couple of weeks ago was pretty phenomenal. The average size was about 14 to 15 inches.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's real good.
We caught that's real good. We caught some really healthy fish, you know, probably the biggest fish was a little over 4 pounds on a fly rod. I mean, it was just a great day.
Yeah.
I'm so ready for this season, and we're filling up. We're getting full. So it's going to be a busy, busy season, but those fish, as long as they participate, and like you said, as long as we don't get that rain on the weekends, we'll be pretty good.
That's it. Well, fill me in a little bit. So I've been looking, I was telling you earlier off air, I've been doing the Sun Catch Slam, trying to catch as many species of panfish as I can. And down here we got black crappie. Was talking with Eric Cagle about the differences between white crappie and black crappie, and how, you know, usually one species is the dominant species in a waterway. It doesn't seem like there's too much rhyme or reason to it. The fish that y'all are catching up there on the Cahaba, is that black crappie or white crappie?
We have white crappie, Alabama bass, red-eye bass, bluegill, and long-nosed gar. We do have, you know, drum, and we have buffalo, and we have carp as well, but those are all kind of later in the season fish. But long-nosed gar, that's probably the one thing that I'd like to say I'm starting to specialize in that. I've got those fish dialed in over the last several years of just picking them apart. And that's probably, I mean, I don't understand why people don't, like, just really love targeting those fish, other than the fact that they're a little slimy and they've got a whole bunch of teeth that could tear you up. But just like any fish, if you handle them well enough, they're usually not going to thrash on you. But, long-nosed gar are a blast and a half. So that's probably one of my favorite ones. But, yeah, that's pretty much it. Long-nosed gar, Alabama bass. We do have some largemouth bass, but not a really big population of them on the Cahaba. We have more on Locust Fork than we do the Cahaba.
Sure. Yeah, the gar thing, man. So I have caught a lot of gar in years past, and I haven't caught one on a fly rod, but that's on my list of things to do. Like, it's still a little cold and the water's still a little high, but if you like to gar fish, I can get you up in some backwaters back here where they spawn. And I mean, I'm talking, you can push pole a canoe up in there and there'd be thousands of them. I mean, you could about
oh,
jump
yeah.
out
And
the canoe and walk on the water.
There.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, And they will definitely, like I've looked, I think me and you have talked about on the show before, rope flies, or I think you were the one who turned me on to the idea of using a really light gauge, light wire barbless hook to try to get some better penetration on them. So you'll have to
That's
drive
right.
down here
Yep,
one of these days
absolutely.
and show me how that's done. I'd like to, I could put you on some gar, and I could put you on some shoe pick and some bow fin. And then you're talking about buffalo fish. So that is a buffalo and red horse sucker is something I got on my list. We have a
It's gonna stay
really,
on your
really? Oh, don't tell
list.
me that. Come on now.
Red horse are easier than buffalo, but good Lord, buffalo are just insane. Like, just, I mean, and we've got an abundance of them on a couple of different sections on the Cahaba, and you can just watch them. You can get right beside them. You can throw your fly right in front of them. You can pull it in front of their mouth. They'll come all the way up to it, won't even touch it. Doesn't matter. I mean, I've been trying. Red horse are tough too, but you can get a red horse like when they're spawning. You can get them in the currents and stuff like that. You can get them to eat a woolly buggers or like a nymph or something like that, something small. You can get them to suck that up temporarily for a second enough to get a hook set on them, and they run and they put up a pretty good fight. But buffalo have eluded me for years.
I was really happy this spring. I started messing with some red horse, and I wanted to just get a feel for them. I took some conventional tackle out there, and I managed to catch three or four of them. Just
That's
bait
impressive.
fishing. Yeah, well, just bait fishing, just a red wriggler. Like, that's the secret to everything in life is a red wriggler. At least as far as fishing is concerned, everything will eat a red wriggler, I'm convinced. But no, I
That's
caught
right.
them, and you were talking about the fight. Like, man, like pound for pound, that's the best fight that I've found in a freshwater fish. Like, if a red horse sucker, if I could catch one that was 5 pounds, oh goodness. They're a really strong fighting fish. And then the buffalo are a strong fish, but I've noticed, like you said, they're tough. They're really, really tough. I've caught a few down here on conventional tackle. I want to do a fly rod, but they're kind of a shoe picker the same way, really. Like, just as far as like investigating and turning their nose up at something. I really think a lot of that comes down to scent and taste. And I tell you what, when old Matt Lewis was down here fishing for chain pickerel, I was joking with him at the start. I said, "Man, I got some catfish dip bait here in the back." I said, "Well, dip your fly and some stink bait. You can catch some shoe pick that way." And he started off laughing. And then we got about halfway through the trip, and he kind of said, "You got dip bait back there for real?"
Yeah.
I made him start to question his convictions as a fly fisherman. He almost fell to the dark
Hey,
side.
the dark side lives in all of us, man. No, my
Is
buddies told me that about buffalo too. I've got one friend who can kind of pull them apart, and he said, "Man," he said, "if you don't get some type of scent on that, either you catch a bluegill or you catch a bass, and you get some of that slime off of it. If you don't put some of that natural scent on it, half the time." If not most of the time, they're just going to avoid the fly. But if you got some type of natural odor or something that's a little bit pungent for them to kind of pick up on, that's the only way you're going to get them. So,
I have seriously considered it. I'm surprised that that's not something that they have on the market. Like, I know they sell slab sauce and stuff like that to go on your crappie jigs. I'm surprised nobody has a little spray bottle that you can spritz a woolly bugger with by now.
now there are a bunch of other clear, odor-free kind of like. Scent-driven things you can use. You can just dip your fly in if you wanted to. I haven't gotten there yet, but I don't know. I won't say I'll never do it.
Yeah, I think the only downside, I think Matt was a little bit hesitant. He had some really big, nice streamers, big fancy flies, and I don't imagine you'd
Oh,
want to
just
put
dip them in
one.
something stinky.
Yeah, I don't imagine you'd want to put that back in your tackle bag after you was done. I don't think you'd want to put that back in your vest.
Oh, no, not a chance. Gotta have a little Ziploc bag for that.
Yeah, there we go. Well, what, circling back to bass here for a little bit, I've actually started tying. I just found me a roll top desk, an ice oak desk on Craigslist for like $50, and I've kind of turned it into the fly tying station. What
Yeah.
what do you recommend that people who tie, what do you recommend people start tying as we move into spring and summer for bass?
Right. So, right now they're chasing anything that gives off a good amount of color, good amount of flash. So anything, nothing super large. If you're going to fish something that's going to be a little bit larger, maybe make it an orange or a black color, kind of imitate like a Helgramite or a crawfish pattern or something like that. If you're going to go 3, 4 inches, something with a lot of body, some decent movement. But the reality of it is, if you really want to catch a lot of fish and catch some good fish, just make something simple. Small bait fish patterns, clousers work fairly well. add things into it, just white and pink. That's a very successful color, even though it doesn't sound like it is, but it's fantastic. White and pink, white and chartreuse, just solid white. Or you could do, you know, a yellow. Yellow works too, white and yellow, or just full yellow streamers. You can add some gold to it, whatever you want to, but just something that's gonna kind of get the fish's attention. Just make sure it's not too large. So I'd say nothing that pushes over about 3 inches, usually about 2 to 2.5 is your money range, because they're going to be feeding on bait fish. They're going to be filling their gut, getting ready for spawn. And their mission right now is just to eat. So if you can give them a good, easy meal with a moderate retrieve, and then they're going to see it and sense it. And if it sparks an interest in one fish, it's going to spark an interest in five, because they're all schooled up right now. So they're just going to smoke it. So that's what I would do.
That's what I like to hear. Well, I'll have to go this weekend. I'll have to visit old Peter Jordan at the Lost Angler Fly Shop and get me some Clouser Eyes. I need to add that to my inventory. So
there you go. Yeah. Oh, and preferably red eyes. I like red eyes. So
duly noted.
I've tried different ones. Yellow works fine, but red seems to just – every Clouser I have with red eyes seems to catch more fish than the ones that don't. So.
Well, I'll get him to give me some small red eyes. I don't know how big of a clouser I can throw on my little panfish rod, but I have been noticing the bluegill wake up first, but I've been seeing some bass cruising where I've been fishing at, and I'd like to tangle up with a few more of them. I've been catching them here and there on top water, but I feel like a clouser would probably do better. But
yeah, you could tie a bunch of clousers on number four hooks, and you could throw that pretty easy on a smaller panfish rod, because that deer here doesn't hold water.
Yeah. That's a good point. It's not going to get waterlogged.
No,
well, I know you mentioned that you were filling up fast, but if you've still got some slots available, if people want to get with you for a float trip down the Cahaba this year, what's a good place to reach out to you at?
Yeah. As of right now, just www.flyfishingalabama.com or Instagram, flyfishingalabama, or Facebook, flyfishingalabama LLC. We're on all of those. We'll be on Guidebook Co. soon, with some other options and some other guides. So you can always look that up too, and you may be able to see some new options here in the future. So to reach out. My phone number's on the website if you wanted to text, or if somebody wanted to call, or if you just want to shoot me a message. I'm pretty flexible.
There we go. Well, guys, Stephen is a great guy to spend some time with, and he's got a really pretty river that he guides on. So y'all go check him out. Stephen, as always, I appreciate you being on the show, sir.
Yeah, man, appreciate you having me. Have a good one.
Absolutely. This week's episode has been brought to you by Mallard Bay. Mallard Bay, the Airbnb-style marketplace for discovering and booking your next guided hunting and fishing adventures. The Mallard Bay platform was built by sportsmen for sportsmen. Their mission is to help expand access to affordable and successful hunting by connecting you with verified outfitters across the U.S. You can browse trips and prices by state or species, select the dates you'd like to go, message outfitters, and secure your dates all from one platform. Plan trips, buy gear, go experience. MallardBay.com. Not sure where you want to go yet? Reach out on Instagram or Facebook and they can help you find your dream hunt. Alrighty, guys, welcome back. And this week we've got Jack West. Jack is the Special Projects Director at the Alabama Rivers Alliance. He's here to talk to us today about just some of the issues that we have in the state as far as water quality and how those impact anglers. Should be a good conversation. We've had Justin Overton and Will Strickland and Cade Kistler on before with the different river keepers. We've had some of the folks from the Black Warrior River Keepers, so I'm excited to talk with Jack and kind of get a bird's eye view on everything. Jack, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Nick. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Happy to talk to you about our work at the Alabama Rivers Alliance and fishing and whatever else you got on your mind.
Absolutely. Well, we were talking a little bit in the pregame warm-up, so I got to ask, you mentioned that you lived up there around Mentone on Little River, right?
I do. I've lived in Birmingham most of my life, but last year, my wife and I, she's from North Alabama around Gunnersville, we moved up to the Alabama side of Lookout Mountain, around Mentone in DeKalb County, and we love it up here. Got a couple acres on a wooded lot close to the river, and it's pretty peaceful. Love to go hike into Little River Canyon, really get away from folks, get away from cell service, and do some fishing.
That's it. Yeah, me and my wife, we love going up there. DeKalb, Cherokee County, all that is beautiful. And then last year I got talking with Matt Lewis, and he turned me on to the whole red eye thing. And
oh, yeah.
Oh, that was the icing on the cake to know that There was a cool little fish in that water. I don't know why I'd never thought to fish it before as many times as I went up there, but last year we went with a fly rod and just had an awesome time twisting my ankles up there in the river chasing those bass. So.
You're willing to hike down a canyon and hike up the river, you can really get away from some people and commune with some beautiful small native fish we got here.
It's a beautiful place. Well, tell me a little bit. I know you're outdoorsy. I've read a little bit on your bio. I know you do a little bit of everything that they have up there in North Alabama, which is a lot between the hiking and the canoeing and the kayaking and the fishing and everything. Give me a little bit of background on your work experience. How'd you end up with Alabama Rivers Alliance?
Yeah, my background is in law, actually, Nick, and I kind of did a mid-career pivot into environmental law and conservation work. I went to Ole Miss for law school and then came back to Alabama in 2013. And I worked with a law firm, a corporate law firm, doing traditional legal work for a couple years. And after a while, I started wanting to marry some of my passions and felt the call to get involved and protect our environment. Started volunteering with Black Warrior River Keeper and some other environmental advocacy groups, and took a leap of faith and jiggered my career in a way to be able to use my legal experience and interest in policy to help protect our rivers.
Well, fill me in. What is the day to day look like? What does Alabama Rivers Alliance do?
That's going to be a mouthful. there's no typical day to day, that's for sure. But I guess I'll start out just describing who Alabama Rivers Alliance is and what our mission is. We were started in 1997, so we're in our 26th year and have been around for a while now. I'm just going to use ARA instead of Alabama Rivers Alliance every time, but
That is the Southern way. Never,
yeah.
never use more word when few word do trick.
Let's shorten it to ARA. But we're a statewide network of groups working to protect and restore all of our state's water resources. And we do that by building partnerships, empowering citizens, and advocating for sound water policy and its enforcement. So we work at the state level. We're not focused on one specific watershed or body of water like some of our partners, but we partner with all of the various Friends of the Creek groups that may just be volunteer led. We partner with all of the waterkeeper organizations, like some that you've already had on the program. We partner with environmental justice groups. We help form new groups when there's a new group that wants to get involved and maybe clean up a creek or has a pollution issue that they're fighting. Sometimes we help form those organizations. So we build partnerships and we have these alliance members. We build partnerships with academics, with state agencies and federal agencies and national conservation groups. We interact in a lot of coalitions working on specific topics like hydropower reform or coal ash. And then part two of our mission is to empower citizens to help everyday Alabamians, people who are out there fishing for supper, or anybody that cares about our waters here, to get involved, to connect with elected officials who make decisions about how we manage our waters. And we've got a couple programs that help do that help empower citizens. One is we put on annual conference that we call Water Rally, and it's actually coming up next month in March. It'll be out at Camp McDowell in the Bankhead National Forest, and there's still plenty of spots available. It's our state's annual gathering of clean water advocates, and we've been doing it for 25 years, maybe 26 years, I think now. And it's a great place for people who want to take that first step from being outdoorsy and conservation minded and interested in environmental issues in the state. But how do they take that next step to become connected to a broader movement and have their voice heard, in Montgomery and elsewhere? So that's one way we do it. We also have a program called the Southern Exposure Film Fellowship Program, and I can send you links to all of these things to include for your audience. We've got a great film fellowship program that we inherited from our partners at the Southern Environmental Law Center a handful of years ago, and we make 4 to 5 short documentary films about environmental issues in Alabama every year. And those are all free They're on the website. We screen them. We do a big premiere in Birmingham and then screen them at various locations throughout the state around the year. You can check out 10 years worth of films at southernexposurefilms.org. And so that's one way that we can elevate issues that may be common throughout the state that different folks are facing. And we share those films with legislators and people working at state agencies and federal agencies, and we use those films in our advocacy. And then that third part, we advocate for sound water policy and the enforcement of sound water policy. So that's the area that I have been most focused in the last few years, advocating at the state level and at the federal level for better conservation and environmental policy. And that takes the form of trying to get our state a comprehensive water management plan so we can manage our water resources wisely and steward them effectively, especially in times of water scarcity, like when we have major droughts. So we leave some water in the river for fish and aquatic wildlife. We've got a bill in the legislature right now that we're working on hand in hand with our partners at some of the various waterkeeper organizations, Mobile Bay Keeper and Coosa River Keeper in particular, and also our partners at Conservation Alabama, called the Shore Act. And we can talk more about that later if you want to. We get involved in the relicensings of the hydropower dams around the state because those dams have major impacts on our water levels and on our fisheries. We try to make improvements when those come up for relicensing, which only happens, once every generation or so. And that's a good overview. I'll stop talking and turn it back to you.
No, that's you're right. That is a mouthful. That's a lot of work that you guys do. Tell me, in your opinion, how do all of these issues impact freshwater anglers? And I know that's a kind of playing the idiot here asking that question. Like, I know that obviously water quality impacts anglers in a very big way, but I guess out of everything that y'all do, what do you think gives anglers the biggest advantage at the end of the day? Like, what's the good work y'all are doing for them?
Yeah, that's a good question, Nick. Certainly, the health of our rivers, our waterways, our water quality, our water availability, how we manage our water resources in the state all directly affect anglers. People who are out there fishing for fun, people who are out there fishing for dinner. And I'll go through a couple different ways that come to mind how our work and just generally water quality and water quantity in the state affect anglers. First of all, you need healthy rivers to support healthy fisheries, to have healthy fish populations and not just fish, but all aquatic life, mussels and snails and turtles and everything we've got in our waters. You probably know, I'm sure your audience knows, Alabama's number one in freshwater biodiversity. So we've got a lot to protect. We've got potentially a lot to lose if we don't protect it.
Yeah, that's what I've always read is that we lead in biodiversity and we also unfortunately lead here lately in extinction rates. So
That's absolutely correct. We're near the top of the list on extinctions too, and we've had some major freshwater extinctions occur in our state in the past due to man-made activities. And so one of the areas where we get involved that I alluded to earlier is you can't have healthy fish populations if you have lots of barriers in your rivers where fish can't get to their spawning grounds. So we have lots of dams in Alabama and throughout the state. And many dams are used for multi-purpose, recreation, flood control, some for hydropower generation, some for water supply. And many of those dams benefit people. We're not trying to get rid of them all. But some of the major big ones, including many of the hydropower dams on the Coosa River and on the Tennessee River in North Alabama, and on the Tallapoosa and on the Black Warrior, those dams really regulate how our waters flow, and they regulate where fish can and cannot go. And so we're working right now on a dam in the Tallapoosa watershed, Harris Dam, which is going through relicensing, trying to get better improvements to how the water is managed, how the dam is operated that would improve habitat for fish and other aquatic species downstream of the dam. So that's something we've been working on for a while. We've seen some success on the Coosa River with the seven hydropower dams there that Alabama Power owns and operates. We did challenge the license that was given to them by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is also called FERC, FERC. we challenged that in court and we won, and we're starting to see some improvements to potential water quality on the Coosa because of it. Of course, you know, the health of our rivers and waterways affect anglers when they go to eat the fish. I know you probably talked about this with some previous guests, but certainly anglers who eat fish or who share those fish with their family or their neighbors or their kids, you know, we have fish consumption advisories on all of our major rivers in the state. And those are for legacy pollutants like PCBs and pollutants like mercury, which goes up into the air when we burn coal and then deposits into our waters and makes its way up the food chain. We're starting to see more consumption advisories for PFAS, PFAS. That's the class of forever chemicals that don't break down naturally. All of this can get into aquatic life and into fish tissue. And then if we eat the fish, guess what? It's in us, and it can have some severe health ramifications. So that's one area where we work, especially with our partners at Coosa River Keeper and Conservation Alabama. And then, of course, any angler that's out there on the water, you know, I've tumped over a canoe or a kayak before and gone swimming when I didn't think I was going to go swimming. Get water up your nose, get water in your ears. Depending on the health, the quality of our waters, if they're high in bacteria and E. coli, we can definitely get sick when we're out there. So the quality of our water and how it's managed is incredibly important to anglers.
Yeah, that's definitely we're not quite there yet, but you give it a couple months down here on the coast, every year it seems like there's somebody hospitalized due to Vibrio. That's a big thing down here in the warm brackish water that we have. And I know Mobile Bay Keeper does a good job putting up swim reports, and it's crazy. You can look at those swim reports and you can watch after a big rain, you can watch the bacteria level spike. And it's like, well, why is that? And it's like, well, like a lot of new development, a lot of sewage runoff, you know. Old
Absolutely.
infrastructure, new stuff that maybe got put up a little too quick. So it's shocking when you look at the numbers and you look at how the bacteria load, like how much it goes up and how fast after a big rain. You definitely, as somebody who spends a lot of time on kayaks and paddle boards and wade fishing, there's some creeks down here I don't want to be wade fishing in the summertime after a hard rain. So
Yeah, I understand. And one of my colleagues at the Rivers Alliance focuses a lot on water infrastructure, on wastewater infrastructure and drinking water infrastructure, and how we improve it and fix some of those leaky septic systems, whether those are municipal systems or just, you know, a lot of Alabamians still don't have access to safe, effective wastewater systems. And so that's one area where we work trying to improve the quality of our water, keep diseases out of our bodies, and keep our water clean. It's not something we necessarily think about all the time, but all of the pipes and the wastewater systems, if they can be effectively either upgraded or maintained, we can really reduce a lot of that risk.
what's the word right now on the Shore Act? I know the session is still in here in Alabama. Is there any news you can give me on that?
It was supposed to be in committee yesterday, but got carried over. We're optimistic that it will be in committee next week, and we'll move out of committee and keep on moving. You know, last year the bill passed the Senate and the House, and pretty much unanimous throughout. We're real optimistic that it will make it into law this session. But there's a lot of work to be done. Of course, the legislature is dealing with all sorts of issues, from gambling to IVF treatment to all these things, and we need more voices to make sure that this is considered a priority and gets over the finish line. You know, most bills don't pass the first year they're introduced. The Shore Act didn't and got carried over into the next session, but we're optimistic that we will get it across the finish line this year.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely rooting for that one. I know when I started reading into it, I think I remember reading it was the year I was born. It was like 1993 was the first time that they attempted to start something like that. I think I remember catching an old article in Montgomery about there being like a parade of bass boats circling Capitol Hill. And it was some really cool old black and white pictures. So
Yeah.
it'd be nice to see that. It'd be nice to also tell me more about the state's water management plan, because I've started reading a book about kind of the water management issues that they've had over in Georgia. And I know Atlanta particularly, like it seems like they're on a regular cycle where every couple years they're worried Atlanta's going to run out of water. What's the deal with Alabama's water management plan?
Well, the main problem is there is not one. That is one that we've been working on for many years now, and Alabama needs a comprehensive water management plan. And you're right, not having one puts us in at a disadvantage to our neighboring states when it comes to drought and water scarcity and growth of Atlanta Metro and Georgia needing more water. It definitely puts us at a disadvantage not to have our house in order in Alabama to have a state water management plan. Right now, pretty much anybody can draw and take as much water as they want to. And there aren't very good restrictions on when you have to cut back. And so our organization has been working to get the legislature to take up the idea and really re-educate them on some good work that was done back around 2012, 2013, 2014, where some state agencies and other stakeholders like our groups got together and began sketching out what should be in a water management plan. For instance, here's just one example, but setting in-stream flow standards. This is relevant to anglers because you can't go fishing if there ain't any water in the river.
Sure.
That would be one component of a comprehensive water management plan for our state that says, yes, we need this much water for industry. Yes, we need this much water for agriculture. We need this much water for household use and things like that. But we also need to leave this much water in our rivers to protect aquatic life while we're in a drought. So you can't just put a big straw in and suck as much water as you want. And I think we're going to see, as precipitation patterns continue to get more extreme and change, we're going to see the need grow for a water management plan. And so our organization and some of our partners have been trying to get the legislature to back up to speed on the issue and get them to, take it up and actually pass a meaningful plan.
Yeah, I know a lot of people, I think, have the assumption Alabama has so much water. It doesn't cross anybody's mind that you ever run out of it. But I know, like here in Baldwin County, where I'm at, since my family came here, I think the population last time I checked, it increased something like 250% or something like that. Like it's almost tripled. And you're starting to read reports where when they survey the groundwater table, it's low. And it keeps receding, and it looks like yeah, there's a lot of water, but a lot doesn't equal infinite. And if Alabama keeps growing, like I think most people kind of hope it does, it would be great for the economy, if Alabama kept growing. But you can kind of look, like I said, you can look there at Atlanta and see what happens when you have growth and you don't have proper planning for that growth. Lots of resources doesn't mean infinite resources. So I think that's interesting that Alabama doesn't have a water management plan. And I think, aren't we the only state? You said in the southeast, right? I think all our neighbors have one.
That's right. All of our neighbors have some form of comprehensive statewide water management plan that's enforceable, and Alabama does not. And you're right. We're blessed with a lot of water. 10% of the freshwater resources in the country either originate in or flow through Alabama. And so we're used to having a lot of water, but that doesn't mean we don't go through some pretty bad times of drought. 2016, I remember, we had a bad drought. Of course, 2007, 2008 were monumental droughts. And even this year, it's been pretty dry up in our neck of the woods, and we had, no burn bans throughout the state. So we definitely experienced the acuteness of periods of scarcity. And what, like you were saying, is we have, if we potentially grow in population, or if more agriculture production shifts to the eastern part of the country because it's getting mega droughts out there in the west, if more of that agriculture production shifts here and we need more irrigation to support it, we could see big changes in the way we use our waters. So we need to get ahead of it and plan for it. And our elected officials and many of the folks at the agencies are doing some work around it, but we still don't have a plan in place.
Jack, I know it's easy sitting here talking about this, like especially you're working with the whole state. You can sit there and you can look at problems and stuff that can be solved, and you can start to get kind of bogged down on it, and it can feel like it's too big of an issue to tackle. And I feel like at a certain point, people, if you're not careful, Like I get to the point where I'll look at an issue and I start checking out. I got too much on my plate, whether it's at work or home life or just projects around the house, right? You see stuff piled up and you're like, man, I'm never going to get it all done. I guess I'll just walk away and go fishing for the weekend, you know, like not even get started on it. What are some projects that y'all have worked on and seen success on? Because I know y'all stay pretty busy and I know that there's a lot of quiet victories. The victories always seem to be less publicized than the fight, at least in the media. And I know, like last time Will was on, he talked about they had a pretty big win, saving some wetlands there in Rabbit Creek, which is a beautiful little fishery. And I kind of went there to celebrate, kind of fish it, catch some bass, look at the red maples, see some of the wildlife out there. Have y'all had any big wins lately? I would like to talk about.
Yeah, sure, Nick. There's one that comes to mind that's a recent win that definitely shows how ordinary Alabamians, ordinary anglers can rise above that cynicism that many of us feel sometimes when it feels like it's hopeless and everything's polluted and our voices don't matter. Over the last couple years, Alabama Power proposed building a new pump storage hydropower plant at a site called Chandler Mountain up in northeast Alabama outside of Gadsden. And that project would have involved five new dams on Little Canoe Creek, which is a tributary to the Coosa. This is all in the Coosa watershed. It would have involved tunneling through a mountain. It would have involved creating new reservoirs. It would have involved potentially forcing people off of land that they'd farmed for generations. And we thought it was a bad idea, and we got involved in the licensing process. We also got involved with the community, and we also partnered with our friends at Friends of Big Canoe Creek and Coosa River Keeper and Energy Alabama and some other environmental conservation organizations. But we were all really inspired by the people in the area of Steele and Gallatin and Chandler Mountain who really came together to protect their land and their waters. And at the outset, you know, these are often multi-year fights, multi-year campaigns, and it can be hard to keep up the stamina. And at the outset, we did hear a lot of people say things like, well, it's Alabama Power. They always get what they want. There's no sense in fighting them. But with a lot of dogged determination and writing comments to federal agencies and talking to state legislators and talking to the media, that community did dissuade the power company from building it. They backed off. They have turned their attention elsewhere, we believe. But we it was a big victory that saved some creeks, that saved some aquatic life, and it can be done in our state. You know, the fate of these places is really up to us. And if we wash our hands and walk away from it and think we got other things to do, you know, these places are going to be fewer and fewer.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've had some firsthand experience with how long stuff like that can drag on and then how it kind of ebbs and flows and the winds of change shift. And I guess it's been 2 or 3 years ago since I went to the first hearing on the closure of the coal ash plant here on Barry. And you kind of watch the ups and downs on that and it drags on for so long. I think the time scale for a lot of, you know, just regular outdoorsmen like myself is kind of difficult on a project like that, you know, staying focused on it and trying to stay active and do your part over that broad span of time. If you don't have a good community, like if you don't have like-minded people, you're not going to do it. You know, if you don't have friends and people that you're cooperating with to make that happen, to kind of encourage you along the way and kind of give yourself a feeling of solidarity, I think you're definitely kind of doomed to failure. I know it's helped me to have friends, you know, whether it was Will at Baykeepers or just some of the local guys, you know, the local characters here on the river who were like, oh no, I'm not letting this one rest, you know, like they gonna get tired of hearing me by the time I'm done with it. If I'm gonna be irritated, they gonna be irritated too.
That's right. And sometimes it just takes a handful of people with that kind of mindset who are not going to let it be taken from them, who care to stand up for the creeks and the rivers, who can't speak for themselves. And it doesn't have to be everybody. We need more voices. We need more people who are willing to reach out and call state legislators or county commissioners or whoever your elected officials are that are calling the shots. But a handful of really committed people can make a huge difference. So we need a handful more.
Well, if that sounds like something that folks listening in are interested in, Jack, where would be a good place for them to learn more? How can they help Alabama Rivers Alliance?
Sure, lots of ways. Again, we partner with all of the Friends of the Creek groups and waterkeeper groups and air advocacy and clean energy advocacy groups. So whatever your passion is, and particularly with anglers, whatever waters you like to fish, figure out, is there a group that I can get involved with to protect the waterways that are my home waters, whether that's a river keeper organization or a volunteer friends of group. And if there's not one, consider starting one yourself. It really can just start with a couple of folks. So get involved with whatever that organization is and start it if there's not one. Of course, we're a 501c3 nonprofit like all of our partners. We generally operate off of donations, individual donations, and some grant funding. So we all can use some financial support, and just becoming members is pretty inexpensive, and you can get call to action emails. So when it's really important to say pass the Shore Act, or when it's really important to show up at a coal ash hearing, you have that information. And if you can be there, show up. Like I mentioned at the top, Nick, we're about to have our annual conference water rally. It's March, let me see, 15th, 16th, 17th. It's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I may have my dates wrong here, but you can get more information about what's going on at the conference and you can register. There are some scholarships involved, so anybody that wants to attend can attend. It's not a particularly expensive endeavor, but it's a great way to take a first step and find that community, like you were talking about. Find those people who want to be in the fight with you and will lift you up when you're down and get educated. And it's a beautiful place to spend a weekend too. There's good fishing in that part of the state as well. So our website's alabamarivers.org. And you can go there and find more information about our work, about the Southern Exposure Film Fellowship, about Water Rally, and sign up for that if you're interested. And we just really appreciate you taking the time to hear about what we do and how we work in partnership with other organizations. And hopefully I'll get to fish with you one of these days.
Absolutely. You mentioned you had red eye bass up there, and here lately I'm a sucker for red eyes, and you'll have to come down here at some point. We got a pretty good chain pickerel fishery down here. If you've never been sight fishing for chain pickerel up in the Cypress Knees,
I have not.
it's
That sounds fun.
worth doing. Bite-sized pike, it's a good time.
I'm adding it to my list.
There we go. We'll swap trips. Well, Jack, I appreciate you being on, guys. Y'all definitely go check out Alabama Rivers Alliance. They do a lot of good work. It really benefits fishermen in a big way.
Thank you, Nick.
This week's episode has been brought to you by Dixie Supply and Baker Metalworks. Dixie Supply and Baker Metalworks offer numerous items to help get your project done right the first time. They carry a variety of different panel profiles and your choice of colors and gauges with all the matching trim and accessories. They also offer a full line of hardware items and post-frame building design. Their friendly and knowledgeable sales representatives are always willing to help answer any questions or concerns you may have. Contact them with any questions or to get a free estimate today. Dixie Supply and Baker Metalworks, your metal roofing headquarters. All right, folks, that's going to wrap it up for this week. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And again, don't forget to text that code ALFFR to 779-345-2918. Get you that free AFCO Sun Protection Mask promo code and get added to our email list so that we can send you the new show each week. This week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report has been brought to you by Killer Dock. Killer Dock combines durability, function, and design to uniquely upgrade your entire dock experience. Visit killerdock.com to see more. And brought to you by Southeastern Pond Management. Since 1989, Southeastern Pond Management has been a leader in pond and lake management services. Schedule an obligation-free consultation today. Call 1-888-830-POND or info@sepond.com. Also by Fish Bites. Whether you're hitting the sand with set rig or fishing the flats and marshes for speckled trout, redfish, and flounder, Fish Bites has something for you. Check out the full line of scented saltwater and freshwater baits at fishbites.com. Also brought to you by L&M Marine. L&M Marine has something for everyone, from small hunting boats to pontoons to bigger bay and hybrid boats for the hardcore angler. You can visit them at 34600 Highway 59 in Stapleton, Alabama, or give them a call at 251-937-1380. And brought to you by Texas Hunter. Texas Hunter Products is celebrating 70 years of engineering the highest quality outdoor products in the industry. You can trust that Texas Hunter Products will meet your needs for generations to come. Learn more at texashunter.com.